Malcolm to come forward and deliver to us words of exhortation. Brother Malcolm.
Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee and his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea and of the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias the tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priests, the word of God came to John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness. That was the way our brother Charlie Mason opened an address which he gave a number of years ago when he was touring Western Canada from England on a speaking tour. And Charlie then faced the question, well, what was John doing? What was John doing in the middle of all that illustrious company? You see, John stands out as the odd man in a very great list. He's no place there. Nobody else would have included John in a list of dignitaries like that. But then as Charlie went on to point out, John was as much a factor of the historical and social and religious scene in that part of the world as any of those other individuals. What that list does is place John in a real, physical, historical context and state that what John said had real meaning in the context in which it stood many years ago. Now, I decided to open this morning's talk that way. We're actually going to talk about the 23rd chapter of Matthew in a few minutes. But I decided to talk about things from that perspective because I've been reading a lot of interesting literature recently. It's entitled Gnostic Scriptures and things like that. These Gospels which have been discovered, these early church writings, and they're causing quite a stir among the scholarly community and that look on biblical studies and things of that nature. And there's quite a lot of real interest then in the diversity of opinion, which was very evident in the early church. And there's quite a lot of real interest in whether our churches nowadays should pick up and should mirror this, and whether that those thoughts which are there in the Gnostic Gospels were incorrectly subdued. So one of the points which I think we all have to consider every now and again and which should really be part of our continuing exhortation is whether or not the scriptures that we read really are reliable, whether they are the scriptures. What makes them different? And what makes them special? And why should we consider these then to be important above any other writings which may have been given and left and lost and now refound? And the answer comes from that list which we just read. Yes, each of these Gospels, each of the four Gospels, has a historical context. Each of these Gospels was drawn from what was happening in the society in which Jesus moved. Each of these Gospels then has a geographical context, a historical context, a social context, and ideas are drawn from that context which we can still understand and appreciate today, even though we live 2,000 years later. And the reason I say that is because almost all of these Gnostic scriptures have one single formula. They're lists of sayings, and they're headed with little phrases like Jesus said, and then Jesus said, and Jesus also said, and then there's another little point which comes in, and it comes in very quietly. And Jesus took me aside and said to me. You see, all of those Gnostic scriptures have that single formula. Many of them were little things which were whispered in people's ears. Things which were understood by just a very few and now passed on to those who need this special understanding. things which have been just kept and stored up as little sayings. But none of our scriptures have that formula. The Old Testament has a historical basis. Even the books of wisdom, like Ecclesiastes and Proverbs, you can pick up the historical inferences and the references to the irrigation systems and so on, which form part of the imagery of those books. Our scriptures come to us with a solid and an understandable framework. And the words which are here make as much sense to us today as they did to people who lived 2,000 years ago, because they're real. They're not secrets. They're not little sayings which are kept for people's wonderment. They're things which are drawn from everyday experiences which still mean something to us. To the 23rd chapter of Matthew. Then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples. And there's a difference already between much of what we read in the Gnostic scriptures. It's not just a saying. It's not just a saying which was given to me quietly in the background, as many of the sayings in the Gospel of Thomas are. It's something which was said openly. And the illustrations came out of what was going on in their society all the time, saying, Jesus spake to the multitude and to his disciples. Everybody was included, saying, the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore, whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. And if we stop there, of course, Jesus is saying something very flattering about these people. And indeed, that was the case. They were the arbiters of justice in that society. They were the people to whom you should go. They were the people that you went to on the steps of the temple to discuss the law on a regular basis. These were the people that ran Jewish society. And there were good things about the way they ran it. So we're talking about what was really going on in the world in which Jesus lived. But, said Jesus, and we picked up a little phrase in our English Proverbs, do as they say, not as they do. That's really what is going on here, isn't it? Now, therefore, whatsoever they observe, they bid you observe, that observe and do, because they sit in Moses' seat. But do not after their works, for they say and do not. I want to pick up one example, and then we'll go back and forth between these first two or three verses and what's going on here in the 23rd verse of this 23rd chapter. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law. For ye pay tithes of mint and anise and cumin. Well, we can, and as I did this last week, we can go to books like the writings of Josephus, and we can find out that that was indeed the circumstance, that we're talking about something which really went on. The tithes were paid. We can go back to the beginnings of this whole routine, and as it was in the books of Moses, and discover that these tithes were being paid for the purpose of looking after the needs of the priesthood. And we can, from the books of Moses, realize that the reason that was done was so that the priests wouldn't have to work on a continuing basis, work with their hands all the time to raise their own food. They would be freed from that labor. They would be freed to spend all of their time in the service of their God. So the reason for doing this, the reason for paying those tithes, was that there should be a group of people who could be representative, who could interpret the law, who could dispense justice, who could do all of these things on a full-time basis without the constraints of looking after themselves. But as we know, as we work our way through the books of Moses even, on into Joshua, on into the books of the historical books, we find that the priesthood becomes more and more diverse. It's separated out into separate functions. as the society got, population got larger, this population got more complex, then it was necessary to separate the jobs that the priests did. There's a whole chapter devoted to the separation of priestly units into musical segments, so that they would all have their turn leading the music of the temple. And we know from the comments made around John the Baptist's parents that the priests took their turns in the service of the temple. So just think about it for a minute. All of a sudden, we're into a very modern society. All of a sudden, we're into a large and complex society which needs a whole system of governance, of regulation, of record keeping. And that's before we actually get to the things that Jesus is talking about here, this business of paying tithes, right the way down to the smallest item. Now you see, we have the problems of collection. We have the problems of storage. We have the problems of transportation, distribution, and all of those things to be carried out on an equitable basis. So it's hardly surprising then, is it, that when we read of some of the comments in the Dead Sea Scrolls and some of the other comments in Josephus and people like that, that we can see what Jesus was driving at. That the business of running the priesthood had taken over. It was essential then for them to look after all the details and say that they were done properly, and they gradually began to let that run their lives rather than the concept that they were supposed to do. And that was to spend their days and all of their time in the service of their God and ensuring that the people, the broader spectrum of the population, had access to God, to the temple, and to knowledge, and to justice, and to all of those other things which were part of Mosaic law. So, maybe we shouldn't be too hard on these people. And that, I think, was what Jesus meant when he said, what they bid you do, that observe and do. They're doing things properly. They're doing things carefully. But they're letting that ruin their lives rather than what they should be doing. And that is looking after the... Well, Jesus picks up three words. First word is judgment, and we would expect that, particularly if we go back and think that what Jesus said, and if you look at a more very narrow reading of this, if they sit in Moses' seat. Because what Jesus is saying here is clearly a separation between the Aaronic functions and Mosaic functions in the law. This was definitely part of the routine that was left to Moses. And Aaron was separated to the more priestly functions, the sacrificial items, and so forth. So we're looking really at the administrative and the detailed structures of Jewish society here. And judgment is one of those things which one would expect to be carried out by people whose values are based upon Mosaic tenets. We should also expect them to dispense mercy. And Jesus said to them that you're not really considering those two things. But the third point that he raises is not one that immediately springs to mind. The third word that Jesus uses isn't one that normally jumps into your mind when you're thinking about taxation, when you're thinking about the routines of running a society, when you're thinking of the problems of maintaining an ordered society, when you're thinking of the problems of maintaining a peaceful society. The third word isn't one that instantly springs to mind. It's the word faith. Now, the interesting thing is, when Jesus said, you're omitting the weightier matters of the law, you've omitted judgment and mercy and faith. When he gets to faith, we have a word which is used almost entirely, at least in my translation, in the New Testament. There are only two cases in the King James Version where words are translated faith. The one is that very well-known phrase, "the just shall live by faith," which is in Habakkuk. And the other is towards the end of Deuteronomy, and we talk about people who have no faith. But if you look at the root meaning of that word, what we're really talking about here is steadiness, consistency, steadfastness, things of that nature. So faith leads to a steadiness of character, a consistency in our behavior, a realization that there is a stable way of life for us. This is what faith comes out as. And that's the root meaning, particularly in the Old Testament. So what we find are terms like faithfulness and faithful in the Old Testament instead of the term faith per se, as it is mostly in the New Testament. Now, the other interesting thing is if you look at the use of that word faithful and faithfulness, about half of the times when it is used of God. We have a hymn, "Great is thy faithfulness, O God our Father." And that's an extraction from the Book of Lamentations. And that's an example of one of the ways in which this thought of steadfastness is presented to us in the Old Testament. That God is steadfast. God hasn't changed. God in the time of Moses was exactly the same as he is in the time of Christ. And that's one of the things which Jesus is bringing out here by picking up that word faith. The steadfastness of God has continued from the very beginning right up till now. And because God was steadfast, God's people could also be assured that their lives could be based on those same steadfast principles. And their lives then could be secure and steady and consistent and have a realization that there was something important in their lives, something in the future for them. And so we step from there, don't we, into the definitions that we have in the New Testament. "I will show you my faith," said James, "by my works." So you see that the critical thing that Jesus was driving at here in this little point that he made was that it should be evident what our values in our lives are. So Jesus, to those people, you've let the running of things take over. You've let the routine, you've let the being accurate, you've allowed the important point of accountability, as we say nowadays, take over your lives so that you seem to do things properly. And that was important. But it was not the most important thing. The most important thing was that they should show that this taxation system was a just system. It was there to promote the worship of God. It was there to promote a steadfast belief in the things that God had said from the very beginning. It was there to continue that worship, that life, which was based on the principles which God had left behind. You see, when we come back to the points which I started with, whether or not we really should be concerned about new writings, new ideas, new thoughts, new gospels, and so forth, we can go back to all of these things because, as we have just said, we can understand, living in a bureaucratic age as we do, where Jesus is coming from. It's rooted in fact and human experience. And the illustrations which are drawn from this are illustrations which we can fully comprehend today, particularly when we discuss things like our medical system. The concept is still there. We can understand it even after 2,000 years. So as we have said, these things were not hidden. They were not secrets. They were open, and they were placed before people in a way that they could understand. Judgment, mercy, and faith. These, said Jesus, ought ye have done, and not to leave the other undone. Now, when we go back and think of another aspect of this thought of faith and the way it's presented to us in the Old Testament, that about half the times in which the thought is presented in the Old Testament, as we said, it refers to the faithfulness, to the steadfastness of God himself. And then that illustration is picked up that because God is steadfast, then we can have faith in God's steadfastness. And I think that point is interesting and very important when we come to another item which is shaking the ecclesiastical world at the moment, and which is also here in this 23rd chapter of Matthew. Whereupon, in the 34th verse, wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them ye shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and purchase them and persecute them from city to city, and that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias. Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them shall ye kill and crucify. Some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues. And we realize that, at least in part, what Jesus was referring to here was his own upcoming crucifixion. That in part what Jesus was saying was that he got to the point in his teaching career where he thought it critical to spend more time with the disciples than with the general populace, as we saw at the opening verse in this 23rd chapter. That he got to the point where he had to concentrate that teaching on his disciples and make it quite clear to them what was going to happen in his life and why this was going to happen. Now, I raise this point and I want you to think back to this question of the steadfastness of God, because the Gospel of Judas has surfaced some years ago. Translation is just becoming available. And it's based on the thought that Judas was the only one who really understood what was going on, that the Jesus had been speaking at great lengths about his upcoming crucifixion. Judas was the only one who actually knew what was happening. And Judas then did the honorable thing by making sure that Jesus was delivered to the scribes and Pharisees to carry out the purpose and the will of God. If Judas hadn't done that, and this is certainly there by strong implication if you read some of the sayings in that book, God's purpose would not have happened, would not have been realized. Judas, therefore, became a hero to certain individuals and to certain sects in the first century Christian family. Does it mean that God's purpose would not have been unfolded if Judas hadn't said something? Does it mean that God could not have done this if Judas hadn't acted? Does it mean that Judas, on his own initiative, brought about the salvation of humankind? That's the implication, and those are the statements, clear statements in many instances, in the Gospel of Judas. You see, and again, we come back to the point which I stressed at the start. Our Gospels, our Old Testament writings, And even the writings of Paul, which don't seem to have a historic, a necessary geographical context, even those writings are all based on what was going on and what people experienced and what people could understand and what people can still find out about and what people can still understand and what people can still experience even today. We have a faith which is based on real substance, on real events, on real circumstances, on real ideas. And those real ideas in many cases come out of the continuing movement of God's purpose. We find in Genesis an indication of what was going to happen to the seed of the woman. We find in Abraham an indication of what should happen to Abraham's descendants. We find in Moses a series of principles which lay down the way God was determined that his people should be cared for. When we come to the prophets, we expand this into the thought of the Messiah and the upcoming things which we're looking at here in the New Testament. And when we come to Jesus, we find the link in the use of that word faith between the Old and the New Testament. We find the steadfastness of God which led us up to Jesus. And then transferred that moving purpose from the notice of physical sacrifice into the sacrifice which we have come to remember here this morning in the sacrifice of our Lord Jesus Christ. And it's there in that word faith. It's there in the illustration that in the Old Testament the steadfastness of God is illustrated as many times as the steadfastness of human beings. And then we come on into the New Testament and realize that their faith was the substance of things hoped for. You see, it's, I think, important for us to realize the debate which is going on around us. But it's important for us to recognize the differences in what we have here and in all of that discussion which is surrounding us. God's purpose would be carried out. And Judas was an instrument, yes, but not the beginning and end of it. God's purpose would be carried out. That's the thing which our faith should lead us to. God's purpose is explained to us in ways which we can understand, in ways which we can appreciate, and in ways which have been openly stated throughout history. And as we illustrated in the question of the taxation system, God's purpose is one which comes to us in examples which, even though they may have been written 2,000 years or more ago, still can be understood just as clearly by our minds today as they were by people who lived 2,000 years previously. And the ancillary questions which keep coming up of whether this was right and who did that and so on and so forth, and whether these secret sayings really should have been, we should not be swayed. We should not be concerned about them. Because when you look at them, they have no in the world in which we live. They're esoteric. They're academic. And in many cases, they're futile. So my exhortation this morning really has two factors. Number one, and it keeps coming up all the time, and more so as the days go on, this question of whether our book really is consistent and believable and relevant in today's world, and yes, it is, and still in my view. And I think we should take heart in that. And the other point is that the illustrations which are here can mean just as much to us nowadays as they ever did to the speakers before us. So we should realize that when Jesus talks to the scribes and Pharisees about comprehending what was going on, about when Jesus says you've misjudged what the weighty matters of the law are, we need to stop and think about what those matters are, ourselves, and not be so drawn up, and we can be, in the matters of our daily lives, and the matters of running a meeting, and the matters of all of the other things that are so important to us on a daily basis. Our faith really should take precedence.